Southampton's Voice.
Voice FM.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Business with Matt Trevis on Southampton's Voice FM. From startups to established companies, I'll be bringing you a variety of guests from Southampton's business community. And I'm really excited to be joined in the studio today with local entrepreneur and MD of Forest Firewood, the incredible Paul Ledger. Paul, welcome to the studio.
Thanks, Matt. Excited to be here. Big fan of the show.
Oh, you're too kind. I'm really excited to have you in the studio today because you have had quite the career, let me tell you. And of course, you're here to talk about your amazing business, which is Forest Firewood, based in...
Wellow.
Based in Wellow.
Just on the edge of the forest.
But before we get into that, I want to talk about some of your early career highlights, if that's okay, because you have a real love for music and festivals, and so much so that you decided to build an amazing business around that passion. So do you mind if we start there and you can sort of tell us the story?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I've always been into my music, festivals and live gigs, especially love supporting places like the Joiners and things around Southampton.
Sure.
But about 10 years ago, I had a good friend and we were talking about how poor the quality of food was at some of the festivals we were going to.
It can be shocking.
Yeah, it was, you know, a decade ago, it was the typical terrible burger van, hardly any like vegetarian or vegan offering. And my friend Andy was running a great little pub in Winchester at the time, and it got itself a Michelin star.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that bit.
Yeah, it's called the Black Rat. And he was working, you know, like most chefs do, incredibly hard, long hours. And we talked about, okay, well, how what could we do? Well, how could we up the game in festival food and give you something that that you own, as well as increasing, you know, the variety that's available in the music scene. And there was a little fledgling pop up for sale. And we saw it at an event called Green Man, and it was called the Hurley Burn. It was run by a husband and wife, and they had two little children, and they'd done 3 or 4 years with it, and it was basically their platform for performing.
Did they literally have the for sale sign up at the festival?
They did.
No way.
Yeah, I think there was a sticker on one of the vehicles or something.
Brilliant.
And yeah, they wanted to go and do something else, and we thought, well, okay, it's great. So these guys have got an in with a few festival promoters, and we like the look of it. It can be tweaked. And they were doing like an auction style format. So we threw our hat into the ring with what spare cash we had available at the time, and we won it. And that was about 10 years ago. And yeah, so we went straight into, I think probably Glastonbury would have been our first ever gig in the circus field.
In at the deep end.
I think we went and rigged the whole thing in a field. It was a massive canvas tent.
Yeah, the stretch tent, which you imported from...
Came from South Africa.
Wow.
Yeah. So originally it was a big canvas tent. And so we built the whole thing once in a field, then went to Glastonbury with a crew who had never done this kind of event catering before. Andy had come from fine dining doing, I don't know, 30 or 40 covers a night.
Yeah.
And we were going into doing 1,000 covers a day of food.
Oh, wow.
So it's huge. It was a massive learning curve for me.
That's a step change, isn't
That's
it?
That's a massive step change, yeah. But we were still super passionate about quality. Everything was handmade, from cooking our own bread, everything. And yeah, so that was the sort of start of that journey. And Glastonbury led into lots of other events in UK and in Ireland. So the event in Ireland that's equivalent to Glastonbury is called the Electric Picnic. That's about 50,000 people at that event. And we took it over to that event that year as well, right up until the year I sold that in 2019.
That was amazing. And it's kind of, to picture it, it's almost like a traveling kitchen. So you were saying it sort of all packed down into three
trucks. Yeah. Three trucks. So the kitchen, the heart of the Hurley Burley, was a lovely 1979 vintage converted coach called Delilah. And we'd have 5 or 6 chefs in there, and it was a full service kitchen with, you know, 2 big 6 range burners, kitchen porters, prep areas, fridges, freezers.
Amazing. Service, please.
Yeah.
On the pass.
Yep. And then that fed out into a big front of house buffet style. sort of service. And
so you had your friend, was he head chef?
He was head chef.
So what was your kind of, what were you up to?
So I was running front of house. I'd never run a front of house before in my life.
Oh, wow.
And I had a fantastic team, a lot of which stayed with us the whole time right up until I decided to sell the business 7 years later.
And before we get into that, I just want to sort of paint a bit of a picture, because your USP was kind of the fact that you had the stage and the sound system, which is quite unique from what you were saying.
Exactly, yeah. There's a lot of pop-up food vendors around, but we kept the sound system, the DJ, the stage, and the performing element. So at Glastonbury, yes, we would have a program throughout the whole week of music, spoken word, poetry, comedy, beatboxing, live music, vinyl mixing. Yeah. Everything throughout the whole week.
I bet that was a kind of real focal point, not just for the festival organisers that thought, you know what, this is quite cool. We're almost getting two for one here. We're getting a bit of a sort of stage and a venue. We're also able to, you know, have some quality food on offer.
Yeah.
So it must have struck a chord.
It does. And it's a brilliant distraction.
Excuse the pun. I didn't even mean to do that.
Yeah. And you know what? It's a great distraction for people while they're standing in a queue of 50 people waiting for their breakfast to be watching a band play. You know, then that time, you know, is enjoyable time rather than just queuing to get your food.
Completely, yeah. It almost takes your mind off the fact you are hungry.
Yeah.
And did you do private hire as well?
Yeah, we did do a couple of events, but the size of the business meant, you know, you probably needed to cater for a minimum of 100 people, because I had 18 people working for me there in the kitchen, drivers, logistics, front of house. So it's got to be of a size and a scale that, you know, that works, that makes it.
You must be pretty good at planning.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to do my project management qualification. I was sponsored by somebody to do that about 15, 20 years ago. And yeah, I sort of believe every hour that you spend planning saves you three.
Oh, so, that's a good, that's a really good anecdote, isn't it?
Yeah.
And no doubt you know your way around a Gantt chart.
I do know my way around a Gantt chart, yeah.
So, you know, the hurly burly.
Yeah.
So what happened? Because obviously that came to an end at some point.
Yeah. So I ran that for 7 years, grew it and grew it from the size, added in more coffee. So bought two really nice coffee machines from Italy, got baristas in, tweaked the menus and things over the years.
Nice.
And sort of grew it and grew it. And so it's quite all encompassing. So you're involved in that from, say, the Cheltenham Jazz Festival in May through to Electric Picnic in October. And it's 6 months really of like full on.
On the road.
On the road. So you turn up at a site, you build the whole restaurant, the kitchen, you do service for a few days, you pack it up, you drive on to the next one. And yeah, after 7 years, I guess I was pretty tired. I think I was ready for somebody else to put a fresh set of eyes on it. And we advertised it, we had a lot of interest.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you must have built up quite the reputation.
Yeah. I mean, we were sort of building it to doing about 1,000 covers of food a day and doing about 15 events per year, each of those events being about 3 to 4 days. So like, you can do the maths, it's like a lot of people through the door.
Yeah.
So we did exactly the same thing. So I did a sort of auction style format.
Nice.
So the way I bought it is the way I sold it. And had a guy who had restaurants in Amsterdam and Cardiff and London, and he wanted an in into the festival scene. So I spent some time making introductions with him, with all of our suppliers, all of the promoters, that kind of thing, and sort of handed it on to him.
Excellent. Sounded like you handed it over in a really cool way.
Yeah, I really, you know, although I wanted to sell it, I was still really super passionate about it.
Yeah.
And I wanted him to continue using all the great ingredient providers that we had built relationships with over 6-7 years. So we're using fantastic local free range meat from a lovely couple in the New Forest called Sarah and Mike. They run a great little business called The Farmer's Butcher. So wanted to make sure that all that continuity was there.
Yeah.
And again, with the promoters, that they could continue, you know, working and doing those events that we'd had so much fun at for a long time.
That's amazing, isn't it? And yeah. Of course, so you sold the business and then you took a bit of time off.
Yeah. So my wife and I decided at that point that it was time for a career break, and we decided to head off in the October of 2019, not knowing what was around the corner. Unfortunately, I just sold an events business at a time when the world was just about to go into lockdown, And we headed off to Australia and did about 4 or 5 months in a camper van and sailing around the Whitsundays, and ended up in Tasmania. Fantastic experience of living in a camper van. I'd always thought about building one, having one here in the UK. So to actually spend 3 or 4 months traveling down the east coast of Australia gave us sort of first-hand experience of what that could be like.
Amazing. So that's something that, had that always been on your bucket list?
Not Australia. It was, we just happened to have some good friends who relocated from the New Forest to just outside Sydney. So we said we'd go and visit them, and then we said, okay, we'll go to the Whitsundays and we'll do some sailing up there. And it was like, okay, well, let's do a camper van and let's road trip it. And, you know, it ended up being a 6,000K, 4 month road trip all the way down. I mean, the scale of Australia is just mind numbing. If you haven't been there and driven it, you just can't fathom like the scale of it.
No. And you did a bit of cycling as well whilst you were there, did you?
Yeah. So we packed up our bikes and shipped them to Australia. And when we were finished with the camper van in Tasmania, we gave that back, went back to Sydney, got our bikes, flew to New Zealand, reassembled the bikes. Put them in the back of a tiny little Cessna aeroplane, little three-seat plane.
Brilliant.
Piloted by a hilarious guy called Murray. He flew us to the very top of North Island, a little place called Cape Ringa. And he stuck the plane down in a field, and we got the bikes out, screwed them back together again. And we set off on a bit of a bikepacking adventure.
Any sort of memories that kind of stand out when you were sort of cycling your way?
I think to begin with that New Zealand is a lot more pokey than I thought it was. There's quite a lot of sort of 1,000 meter climbs. It's a good workout. There's not many flat bits. It's definitely not Holland.
And you were carrying all of your kit with you?
Yeah, we were totally self-supported.
Oh,
so we could go about 5 days. The Department of Conservation, which is basically, they own about half the land in New Zealand, and they created all these bike trails out of old railway lines, logging tracks, cattle trails, that kind of thing. So there's quite a well-mapped route that you can follow and do it all off-road. We didn't want to do any of it on the road, so it was all off-road. Some of it was cycling down beaches for 100K in like the hard-packed sand. Basically, your limiting factor is water. You've got to be able to get some water every day.
Yep.
But they've mapped it all out where you can get some rainwater that's been captured off a roof, and you can boil it down, cook yourself some food, and on you go.
And you quite like the off-grid lifestyle, don't you?
Yeah, massively.
That gives us a little bit of an insight into what we're going to be talking about in part two, which we're going to be delving into your experience, and you're still doing it now as an Airbnb host.
Yes.
And there's this beautiful link to that and what you're doing today around the sort of forest firewood stuff. But I've got to just tell the listeners that, Paul, I can tell that that time in New Zealand and Australia, it was clearly an amazing memory for you because you were literally grinning from ear to ear. Would you go back?
Yeah, I've definitely got unfinished business with New Zealand because we actually had to cut that trip short about 80% of the way through. We'd pedaled about 2,500 kilometres. We had about another 1,000K to go, and then Jacinda Ardern locked that country right down. And we had to go and hunker down on a dairy farm for a month or so.
Mm.
So yes, I definitely feel I've got unfinished business with NZ, and I will be back there to pedal that last bit.
Good man. Yeah, because you worked your stay, didn't you?
At
the dairy farm.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was great. They were the most lovely, hospitable people. Alongside wild camping, every sort of 10 days or so, we'd check into like an Airbnb or just something interesting and quirky. And I happened to find this house just reading a magazine in a cafe where we'd stop for a coffee. I love my coffee, so we were always doing coffee stops.
Good man, yep.
And it was a place called the House with No Nails. And it was a house that a Welsh guy had built out of storm-blown trees on a plot of land that he had bought from a guy in a pub. And I was like, I've got to go and stay in this place. And Jen and Dowie, that's the couple who own it, are still good friends of ours, and we're still in touch with them.
Oh, well, shout out to those guys.
Yeah. And yeah, so we stayed there whilst we were organising what we were going to do and returning back to the UK.
Amazing. Well, look, hold that thought. We're going to take a short break. We've got some ads. We've got a little bit of music to play. And this dovetails beautifully to how you got into, you know, the Airbnb side of it. And of course, we're going to be delving into your incredible business, which you're doing now, which is the Forest Firewood business. So don't go anywhere. Part two and part three are going to be amazing. Back after the break.
Voice FM.
You name it, we'll collect it.
So a bed?
Yep.
A sofa?
Yep.
All right, what about a shed?
Yes.
So anything?
Everything non-hazardous.
Hi there, I'm Steve.
And I'm Woody.
And we're the co-founders of Ethiclear.
We collect waste and clear houses.
And we do it ethically.
Because if your waste is good enough to be used again,
we'll make sure it is.
As Ethiclear has a network of like-minded people around Southampton.
So for anything,
of almost any size,
that you can't shift,
book your clearance at ethiclear.co.uk.
So I got a home office in the garden, and in the spring and the autumn it's perfect. But in the middle of winter and summer, it's not fun. The heater costs a fortune when it's cold outside. And in the summer, opening the windows just isn't enough. Which is why I got Just Coolers to install a small air conditioning unit. It keeps me cool in the summer and warm in the winter. It's the most cost-effective way of doing it. And with a 5-year guarantee and prices from £799, what's not to like? For your free quote, just visit just-coolers.com and keep your home office just right.
Voice FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Business with Matt Trevis on Southampton's Voice FM. I'm in the studio with Paul Ledger, MD of Forest Firewood. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm great, thanks, Matt.
What a fascinating career you've had. We were just talking about Paul's time with the Hurly Burly, which was this kind of roaming festival cafe.
Exactly.
200-seater restaurant, 1,000 yep. covers a day, yep. travelling the country, delivering incredible food to festival goers. And then you went and did a bit of travelling.
Exactly, yeah.
Around New Zealand. And then you obviously, right now, you've got the Forest Firewood business based in Wellow.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, where did the spark come from for that business?
Yeah. Okay, so about 10 years ago, around the same time as starting up with the Hurly Burly, I bought a derelict house in the New Forest. Well, it was next to a pub, and the pub, I was trying to buy the pub. The pub fell through, and that's why I ended up with the Hurly Burly. But the house was still really interesting, and it was a derelict house in a beautiful spot. But it had nothing connected to it. It had no power, no water, no drainage. It was literally four walls.
No utilities. Didn't even have a roof, did it?
Didn't have a roof on it. Most people just wanted to knock it down. It was totally overgrown with brambles. It had squatters in it, fires. It was a real wreck. And I managed to find the guy who owned it, and obviously caught him on a good day, and we had a chat on the phone, and we managed to come up with a sensible number there and then. And so I bought the house and started working on it. And at the time I lived in a rental house, which was heated by oil, and filling up the oil tank was like over £1,000 every time. And it just didn't feel like the right thing to do. I didn't like the smell of the oil boiler outside. I didn't like burning fossil fuels. And none of it sat comfortably with me. So I said, okay, this house is going to be as green as we can make it.
Nice.
10 years ago. So we're not going to burn any gas. Well, there's no gas out there at that part of the forest. We're not going to burn any oil. So that means renewables. So I got in touch with a company down in Devon, and they helped me design a system that was based around solar panels on the roof, which heated hot water, solar panels on a garage roof, which created electricity, and a wood burner in the living room, which had a heat exchanger on the back. So when you lit the fire, that heated your hot water cylinder, ran your underfloor heating, all the rest of it. Superb system. Works really, really well.
And I think you were ahead of your time a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, it was sort of definitely tying together a few different technologies that had existed and been out there for some time, but bringing together underfloor heating, wood burners with back boilers on, solar PV, solar thermal. You know, the pricing of all of that stuff was a lot higher than it is now because not many people were doing it. But I thought, okay, this is a really long-term commitment and investment, so I'm going to sink the money into it now. Anyway, so that will work. We've got it all up and running. But of course, if you've got a house that for 6 months of the year you need the fire on, you need to put something in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some Leylandii trees around the site, which I had chopped down, but they went pretty quickly because they're softwood and they're pretty useless in a wood burner. So I needed to find a supply of hardwoods, decent hardwoods. And as luck would have it, there was a farm at the end of the lane that had been up for sale for ages and they couldn't sell it. It was in a real bad state. So they chopped it up into seven little parcels. And one of the parcels was a tiny little bit of woodland. And as luck would have it, we put our hat into the ring and we managed to buy this tiny little parcel of land, which hadn't been managed very well. So there was loads of fallen trees and things like that on it. So I started harvesting and coppicing my own fuel, got myself a chainsaw license, taught myself what I was doing, and started creating my own fuel to run my house with, which is, you know, quite a circular, nice way of doing it.
Mm. Did it take much time?
No, I reckon I spent maybe a day per month for 6 months of the year. So for 6 days a year, that gave me all the fuel that I needed for heating and hot water.
Mm.
So I felt that was a good trade-off. If you think a house probably costs a couple of £1,000 a year to heat, I figured 6 days of my time being out in the woods, chopping wood, and then I was doing it all manually. I was doing it old school with a chainsaw, with a big Swedish axe and a chopping block and a trailer. Yeah, I didn't really know any other way.
And you didn't know at the time, but you obviously, those skills have come in very handy.
Yeah, exactly. So, that sort of ticks along really well. And then I met my future wife at a lunch at that house. And she was working up in the Midlands. So we moved away up to the Midlands. So this house was sat there empty. I was like, oh, that doesn't seem right. You know, I've just restored this building. It sat there empty most of the time.
Great location.
Lovely location in the forest, right out on the open forest. And a friend of mine who had helped me with the restoration said, why don't you stick it on Airbnb? And I was like, whoa, what's Airbnb? She says, it's going to be big. Trust me.
This is going back, what, 10?
To 2014.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
So had a look at this thing. It was, you know, quite big in the US at that time. I think there was 200,000 listings or something in the US, but like very little in the UK and nothing in the New Forest. So yeah, took a chance on this thing, put it on there, and it just took off from that point onwards. And it's just gone exponential really from that point, where for the last few years we have been full 52 weeks a year.
Oh wow.
It's an incredible platform. We're coming up to, I think, our 800th set of guests through that house.
Crikey.
I'm sort of mixing Airbnb and firewood here,
but the
two are kind of inextricably linked, really.
They are. I'd love to delve into, if we've got time, you know, what it takes to be a great Airbnb host. But before we delve into that, so did you have a meeting with a tree surgeon? And that was quite a pivotal moment for the forest.
Yeah, that was. So I've sort of been ticking away, doing my own thing, creating my own, you know, firewood for my own personal consumption. And then I had a tree surgeon come in and do some work, and got chatting with him. And I was like, you know, what do you do with all the wood that's left over at the end of the day? And he said, well, we normally stack it by the side of the road, and come the morning, it's gone, you know, or we put it through a chipper, and we spray it all around the verges, as you see them doing along the sides of the motorways and things. Yeah. And I was like, but there's money there. You know, it's like there's a usable, tangible fuel that you're either just throwing away or giving away. So that made me think, okay, how scalable is what I'm doing on a domestic level just for me? How much margin is there, or potential is there to do this, you know, properly as a business? So I kind of had a look around at a couple of the other people in the New Forest doing the same thing, and thought, okay, if I'm going to get serious with this, I can't be doing it with, you know, my trusty old 30-year-old chainsaw and a splitting axe.
And an axe, yeah.
Yeah.
Going biking.
Yeah, we're not going to get anything produced that way. So invested in a machine from Sweden. Fantastic piece of kit. You basically just feed logs in one end. It cuts it for you. It drops it. It splits it. And then there's a conveyor belt that stacks it up in a bag. So it can basically, it increases your efficiency about 1,000%. And it's really consistent. It gives you really nice, even, consistent size logs all the time. So bought that, put that up in the farm in Wellow. And then my friend Daryl started to get lots of work coming in on the tree surgery. So logs were flying in, and it was, you know, we could barely keep up with what was coming in. And I thought, okay, well, there's no point having a barn full of 200 tons of timber. We actually need to get this stuff out there.
Need to find an outlet.
Need to find an outlet. And so I had a fantastic girl called Elle Dean build a website for me, and she said, you must be able to buy online, because none of the other log people you can buy online locally. You just call them up and say, I want, you know, X number of logs. I was like, oh, wow. People really going to buy logs online? She's like, yeah, trust me, they will. So she built a website with a pay function on it. And about 50% of our orders now come from online. In fact, I was out delivering this morning, and three of those customers were new customers that had just found us on a Google search, ordered online yesterday, and then their orders got delivered out today.
I think Jeff Bezos said, there's a quote, he said, it's difficult to find things that won't sell online these days.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right.
And you said it's not taking you long to break even.
No.
It's flying, yeah.
Yeah, it's our 100th new customer I delivered out to this morning.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
Century.
Yeah. And yeah, I think the website and sort of deliveries only went live back in November. So that's in sort of like 3 months of getting really serious with it.
Amazing.
So yeah, picking up about one new customer a day. So thank you very much to all of our customers.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because when we were talking earlier in the week, and I sort of said, Paul, you know, what do you think it takes to build a successful business? And you said something that was really interesting, and it stuck with me ever since. And you said, put some effort in and give people what they want. And I think that's great. Do you still sort of stand by that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that sort of stands in sort of everything I've done, really. Is, you know, the hospitality business with sort of heads on beds with Airbnb. You know, I still go and check that house before every single guest comes in. I want that to be absolutely on point for them. I still check the moisture content of every single bag that goes out the door and do a check.
Yeah, because the moisture content for this is for the logs. This is
exactly
not,
yeah.
This is not
moisture content of Airbnb. Yeah,
but that moisture content has a dramatic impact in terms of what happens when you start burning the wood.
Absolutely, yeah. It's super important to be burning seasoned timber. And the reason wood burners get bad press is generally down to either poor wood burners, or wood burners aren't very efficient, or by burning wet timber that hasn't been seasoned properly.
Yeah. You've actually got some interesting facts, because we're going to be, in part three, we're going to be delving into, you know, the sustainability around burning wood.
Absolutely,
yeah. We're going to be debunking some of those myths. But before we go into that, I just want to circle back around to the Airbnb side of it. The heads on beds.
Heads on beds.
Because obviously that business is still going. You're running
very much
alongside.
Yeah, it's. I've got a fantastic team. So I've got a brilliant team of housekeepers, gardener, linen person. And really, that business, I can run that on the phone now. So I sort of give that 30 minutes a day.
Oh, wow.
Just making sure we're sort of on top of all of that. Inquiries, messages, that kind of thing. And in terms of being a good Airbnb host.
Yeah, what's the secret to success? What's the secret sauce?
Okay. I think it's just more than providing a space for somebody to sleep and eat. People come away for an experience. If you're booking a house for 8 or 10 people, you're probably bringing your friends or your family, and you want to have a good time. And if you're from outside of the area, most of our guests are from London or quite a lot from abroad, you don't really know what's good in the forest. You know, you can do some research, but you know, where are the good places to eat? Where are the great mountain biking trails? You know, where can you go paddleboarding or kayaking? You know, what if I want somebody to come in and cook for me? So all of these things we can organize for people, because my wife grew up in the forest. I've lived in the forest for 15 years now. And you know what are the good things. So I can wholeheartedly recommend like great places to go for a killer Sunday lunch or how to organize, you know, a lovely kayak trip in the morning going up the Beaulieu River on the flood tide and, you know, coming back down on the ebb tide, stuff like that.
So it's nice and easy.
Yeah, so it's nice and easy. Yeah, definitely don't do it the other way around. And and that's really what I think is the key to being a good Airbnb host. Keep the place immaculate. So, you know, a lot of money gets reinvested back into making sure decor is totally up to scratch. And we had a lovely review the other day of a guest who I hadn't realized she had been one of the first 10 guests back in 2014, and she came back nine years later, and her review said this house is still as immaculate and cozy as it was 10 years ago.
I need to book a stay.
You do.
I think that's great. And you still meet and greet?
I don't do so much meet and greet now. I used to live very close by. Now I'm in Brockenhurst, so it's an hour's round trip.
Okay. But it sounds like you've got the process down and guests are loving it and they just have this amazing experience. So yeah. Kudos to you, really.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I mean, if people do want us to meet us there, we will do so. But a lot of people, the check-in process is super simple. Really easy,
and that's what people want, isn't it? They just want to like get in and switch off and just enjoy the holiday.
Exactly.
Well, I've no doubt that business will still be running in years to go, because it's something that I can just see you're incredibly passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, giving people a good experience, you know, whether it's plating them up a beautiful vegetarian meal at a restaurant in a field, or you know. Seeing the feedback from people after they spent a few days, you know, in your house in the forest, I really like that, giving people, you know, the best possible experience.
Absolutely. And of course, it's probably going to increase your repeat bookings.
Yeah. Yeah, we do get a lot of repeat bookings on the Airbnb. The sort of challenge we get now is people come back, and if they don't get on it in terms of booking, they find that it's already gone.
It's so, already booked out.
Yeah, so you find, like, you know, Christmas next year or this year has already, you know, been booked out.
If people are out there and they want to have a search on Airbnb for this amazing place in the New Forest, what do they need to search?
If you just put history and luxury eco house into Airbnb, it'll pop up. I think we come up on the front page of Airbnb for houses in the New Forest anyway.
Amazing. I'm looking for something to do in the summer. That could well feature.
Yeah.
So look, don't go away, because we've got part three coming up, and me and Paul are going to be chatting about some of the challenges he's faced along the way in his amazing business journey. We're going to be talking about the sustainability around burning wood, which is really interesting. Paul's got some fantastic facts. And we're also going to be asking Paul that question of, you know, if he was sat opposite someone that wanted to start a business, what would he say? What wise words, what pieces of advice would he give someone starting a business? So yeah, don't go away. Join us after the break.
Live and local. Voice FM.
Let's hear more from Ian at Station Motors.
I think it's important to have a family business. My customers relate to it. I've been doing cars for people, and now I'm doing their sons' cars. My daughter works in reception, and my son's nearly a fully qualified accountant. He does my bookwork, both very good drivers. I used to walk to school past his garage. It was a petrol station back then, so I ended up buying the garage off that family, you know. So I like to think I brought my family into that family business.
Station Motors Woolston, by the Itchen Bridge.
This is the sound of exercise when it's made fun. It's called Visosport, and it started in Southampton. You meet up, you play fun games, you exercise, you laugh, you keep fit. It's for people of all abilities. Visit visosport.net or search for Visosport in Meetup and have fun getting fit.
Southampton's Voice.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Business with Matt Trevis on Southampton's Voice FM. And I'm joined in the studio by the incredible Paul Ledger, who is MD of Forest Firewood, based in Wellow.
Correct.
And we've been talking about your incredible business journey and career, which is just, I find it absolutely fascinating.
Oh, thanks.
And we've been dialing in on Forest Firewoods. And of course, you're also a fantastic Airbnb host, by the sounds of it, with a lovely little property in the heart of the New Forest.
Come and visit.
I need to. Yeah, I absolutely need to. Providing there's some coffee and some good beer, I am there. What I'd love to delve into now, Paul, because we've been talking about, you know, the sustainability of, you know, burning firewood and whether or not it's good for the environment. And you've got some interesting stats, which I think may change some people's opinions.
Yeah. Wood burners have been coming in for a lot of flack recently in the press. And I heard
and they've grown in popularity, haven't they?
Yeah, massively, yeah. Wood burner installs are going up like 30% a year. So the governing sort of regulation, like HETAS, who install these things, like the sales are really high and they're growing. And that's actually a really good thing, because new wood burning stoves are like way more efficient than old wood burners. And since 2022, any like wood burner sold had to like conform with like some new EU regs about how efficient it is. So basically, they now have to be 80% efficient. So that means if you put something into it, at least 80% of that energy comes into the room or into the water, and only 20% goes up into the chimney and is wasted.
How do they even measure that?
Okay, so you would take a piece of timber has a calorific value, a bit like a meal that you would eat.
A Mars bar.
Like a Mars bar. So if you take a lump of beech or ash or oak, for every kilo, it's got a calorific value. So what they do is they would light that piece of oak or beech. They know exactly how much heat is contained in that. And then they measure the radiant heat coming off of that. Oh. Or if it's a wood burner with a stove on the back, how much heat is transferred into that that water.
It's not just a business show here. It's also a bit of a science lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I vaguely remember doing something at school with this, with measuring the calorific content of something on a Bunsen burner. It's basically that on a big scale.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's why it's also really important to burn hardwoods, not softwoods. The calorific content of hardwoods, so beech, ash, birch, oak, is way higher than softwood. So, like, you know, you'll see people like wanting to burn old pallets and bits of pine and all the rest of it, and it will just evaporate super quick in your fire. You won't get much heat out of it, and also scrap timber, it's a bit of a no-no. It contains lots of toxins. Definitely don't ever burn anything painted.
MDF.
MDF, absolutely not. No. So, use well-seasoned hardwoods. The government sets a level of 20% or less. The bags I shipped out this morning were at 13%. That's the same level of moisture in them as you were getting in kiln-dried timber. And that's another sort of misnomer, is that you've got to burn kiln-dried timber. You don't. We think it's absolute madness to be firing a kiln with gas to dry timber to then put it into your wood burner.
Doesn't make any sense.
That's total madness. Yeah, if you're going to do that, just put your gas boiler on and cut out the middleman.
Don't even bother having a wood fire.
A wood burner, no. So kiln-dried timber, you do not need to burn kiln-dried timber. You just need to burn seasoned...
That's properly prepared.
Hardwood, seasoned timber, that's it. Wants to be about a year old. It just needs time. Put it in a sunny, well-ventilated area. And, even if you felled some trees from your own back garden, say you've had a tree surgeon in, leave them somewhere breezy, leave them somewhere sunny. Get yourself a little moisture meter off of Amazon for a tenner. And when it's below 20%, you can burn it.
Nice. And what about the misconception around burning the wood? It creates kind of more carbon dioxide.
Right, yeah. So as a tree grows... as we all know, it sucks in loads of carbon dioxide, which is brilliant, which is why the government has set standards for creating loads of new forests, etc. So a log will only release the carbon that is locked up in it during its growth process. And that, for each kilo of wood that you burn, gives about 8 grams of carbon out. In comparison, gas releases 120 grams of carbon and electricity 517 grams of carbon.
Wow.
Yeah, when used for heating. So, no, it's a complete misnomer. It is carbon zero. And if you can use a locally sourced fuel as well, so we deliver with it.
So it hasn't got a lot of air miles.
Hasn't got a lot of air miles on it as well. That's even better, because you haven't, generated any carbon in shipping it out. And we're based in Wellow. We ship 10 miles radius of there. So it's all very local.
And of course, that carbon that gets released when you burn the piece of wood, let's say, for instance, the tree's fallen over in the forest, mm-hmm. and it decomposes naturally, that carbon is going to get released regardless.
Correct. Yeah. And that's important as well. It's important that a certain number of trees are still allowed to fall down in the forest and decompose, because that's really important for biodiversity, to create habitats and things for bugs and creatures to live in. So that's why you'll see in the forest, in the 200,000 acres there, you'll see a lot of fallen timber that just stays there for biodiversity reasons.
Mm. And some people might find that when they're burning the wood, it can almost create not a very nice smell, or for instance, it leaves black marks on their walls. And is that because it's not seasoned?
Yeah, that's right. So that's a creosote, that's a tar. If you're getting that black build up on the inside of your stove, you're not getting a good enough airflow and it's not burning hot enough.
Mm.
Yeah.
You definitely know your wood.
Yeah, well, I've had wood burners for about 20, 25 years. And then when I built the Airbnb house I sort of made wood as like the central part of the heating process, I really kind of had to gen up on that and learn what worked and what didn't.
But you enjoy it though, don't you?
Yeah, it's great. Everybody's really happy. Like whenever I drop a bag of fire around to them and...
it's because they're getting warmth.
they're getting warm. And, most people seem to really enjoy buying something that's local from a local provider. we joined up with a little body of people called the New Forest Mark.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's an association, a sort of collective of people who promote New Forest businesses within the forest. So you've got people in there who have beehives and create honey and sell that. You've got people like myself who, you know, take fallen timber and, you know, create firewood out of it. There's carpenters on there who'll take, you know, bits of oak from the forest and make you a lovely set of gates and pretty much everything in between. So yeah, New Forest Mark is something really worth checking out. You can go on their website and it's sort of all broken down by category, and there's sort of experiences on there as well. So people who offer some of those things I talked about earlier, kayaking, cycling, that kind of thing. There's people who are part of the New Forest Mark.
Absolutely. So what are we saying then? If you have a you know, a burner,
mm-hmm.
then you can affect, is it almost like being carbon neutral?
It is, yeah. So those logs that you're burning will only release the carbon that was sequestered, that was locked up in them during their growing process. And you can actually even have a wood burner in a smoke-free zone. So some city centres, so DEFRA, which is Department of Food and Rural Affairs, they have classified some stoves as being so clean, so efficient, that they are allowed to be used in a smoke-free area.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. So, there's just some really well-designed tech coming into the stoves now. You know, new stoves are way more efficient than ones from 10 years ago. And, like, open fires are terrible. I mean, they're super inefficient. They sort of operate the other way around, whereas 80% of the heat goes up the chimney and only 20% into the room. So I know they look beautiful, but they're hugely inefficient.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well, thanks for sharing that, because I think it's good to dispel myths on the show.
Yeah, for sure.
Can we delve into some of the challenges that you faced along the way, and maybe you could share a bit of insight in terms of, you know, how you've overcome them? Because I really like to do that. And of course, you know, if it's food, I think you said, you know, anything from food, heads on beds or firewood, you know, you're only as good as the people that you sort of surround yourself with. And it's about looking after your people.
Yeah, definitely. I think probably the area I've learned that most in was in food. You know, we had a set number of people that we needed to make service work, as in any kind of cafe or restaurant. Yeah. And everybody needed to be on point during service because you've got a huge queue of people. And they've got to want to be there. And so I think one of the things it took me a long time to learn was what motivates people. Mm. Some people wanted to be there because they wanted to go to Glastonbury, and that was the only way they were going to get there was to work a shift. Other people were motivated by the money, because unlike a lot of festival food traders, we paid all of our staff, like the going rate. So if you're a barista, we paid you what your barista rate would be working in a cafe on the high street. Whereas a lot of people would just say, right, we're going to give you a ticket for free. The ticket's worth 300 quid, but you come in and do 20 or 30 hours worth of work. Mm. I didn't think that was right. So I paid people and I gave them a free ticket.
Yeah.
So working out what people's motivator was like really crucial. And it did take me quite a long time. You know, some people were motivated by time off. And the other thing was, especially if you've got a business that maybe doesn't work around standard working hours or practices, is working out when people are good. You know, you've got owls and larks.
Yes.
And our busiest period in Hurly Burly was breakfast. And not everybody is at their best at like 7 in the morning, ready to smile and greet,
yep.
you know, 500 people coming through the door.
Yep.
So getting the right pegs in the right holes, took me a few years to work that one out. But when you've got it right, it just flows along like a beautiful thing. Everybody has a great time. The time, you know,
flies
by. You have a great service.
That's such a good bit of advice. Paul, I'm really curious, because what is next for Forest Firewood? What's on the horizon?
Okay, well, next year or this year, I'd like to work with more tree surgeons, buy in more green waste that we can process. If it continues the way it is, we will definitely need to be working with more people. So any tree surgeons listening out there that would like to sell their waste, we would love to buy it from you. Mm. We've got a site where you can just come and tip it off, or we can come and collect it from you as you're working. So super flexible.
Perfect, yeah.
But not everything that comes into us needs to be chopped up and go through a wood burner. Sometimes we get long stems of timber come in that are really nice. And you think, oh, okay, well, that you know, we can make something out of that. And we've had trees come in before, and I've got a friend called Alex who's got a lovely business called Bearwood Carpentry, and he's got a mobile sawmill. So Alex comes along with his mobile sawmill, lift up the log on the machine, dial in what you want, and he sends us out lovely timber out the other end of it that we can then go and make things with, or, you know, use in interesting construction projects.
Oh, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great, and it's mobile, so you can take it to like where the tree's fallen. So yeah, I'd like to definitely look into potentially adding in a sawmilling service, which we can either take to site or have that up at the farm. Because also we import a huge amount of timber into the UK.
I couldn't believe when you told me the stats, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, so 81% of timber that we use in the UK is imported, and it's not just imported from, you know, across the North Sea from Finland. Unfortunately, a lot of it is coming from China and the US. Last year, it was £9 billion worth was imported, and that is set to increase fourfold because the use of timber in construction is going north. Mm. And the use of brick and concrete is declining because you can build better, warmer homes, timber framed. So sort of, you know, I'm not thinking I'm going to take on Dewson in the world of supplying timber here, but, you know, we need to start growing and using and harvesting more of our own timber rather than bringing it from the other side of the planet.
Absolutely. Hey, a quick question for you. So if you were sat opposite someone that was thinking about going into business, or maybe they're currently employed and they want to make the leap and go self-employed, what would you say to them?
Go for it.
Go for it.
Yeah. I've got absolutely no... I mean, this country is built on innovative small business startups. What advice would I give to somebody wanting to make the plunge?
Because I know you said about just, you know, validating the business concept.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't just take something that's currently your hobby or your passion and think, yes, there's definitely a market for that. You know, get out there, check it, validate it, make sure that there really is before you go all guns blazing and sink everything in. So I wasn't really sure how Forest Firewood was going to pan out. So we started small, and, you know, having
run it up the flagpole,
see how it was, and you know, now I can start scaling up for next year.
Oh, do you know what? It's absolutely brilliant, Paul. Honestly, we're nearly out of time, but I just wish you the best of luck with this. And I think you've got a really exciting year ahead. If there's anyone out there that's thinking, do you know what? I want to try some of your firewood. What do they need to do?
Oh, you can find us on Insta. You can go on forestfirewood.net. You can just place your order online. You can call us. We'll speak to you down the phone. Just take an order there and then anywhere you want to order.
Brilliant.
We'll run some out to you.
Fantastic. Well, look, Paul, thank you so much for coming into the studio today. You've been a brilliant guest.
Thanks. It's been a really good experience.
Well, you're most welcome. So that's it for this week. Join me again next week where I'll be interviewing another incredible guest. Bye for now.
Voice FM. Voice FM.
Don't put in your recycling bin greasy pizza boxes. And don't put in your recycling bin dirty tins and dirty plastic bottles.
If any of your recycling is dirty, greasy or wet, your whole bin could be rejected. So follow this golden rule. Keep your recycling clean, dry and loose. And remember,
don't put in your recycling bin greasy pizza boxes.
This message is supported by Voice FM. And if you want to know more about recycling in Southampton, visit voicefmradio.co.uk/recycling.